You think your world is safe? It is not.
Who the hell are you?
I am better.
At what?
Everything. Shall we begin?
Hello and welcome to an audio review of Star Trek Into Darkness with me, Ryan, and Stu from Geek of Oz. How are you going today, Stu?
Not too bad. Not too bad at all.
That's good. Now, what I thought, instead of us just getting behind the keyboard and nutting out some review, number one, my fingers are sore. I've been writing a fair bit lately. But apart from that, I thought that what we do, we've both seen Into Darkness. I'm a lifelong Trekkie. I've spent the fair share of my youth watching a black and white television, no less. Started off with Next Gen, was my big thing, and I'd stay up until the wee hours. Sometimes it wasn't on, sometimes it was. For some reason, it seemed as though we only got it on TV sporadically. Sure enough, there wasn't a massive audience for it, so. But it really, to me, it spoke to me about how great society can be and how, you know, we might be on the right path. I never looked at it and thought that Roddenberry was doing this Scientology thing where he's telling us that the world's going to be great and everything else, but it was a lovely story, you know. And the reason I wanted to do this review like this is because I love Star Trek, always have. You, not so much.
I'm more of the Star Wars camp, always have been. I remember sitting up late night when Next Generation used to come on, and I used to have to slog through it to get to wait for David Letterman to come on. So I was always anti-Star Trek for the most part. If anyone's seen Fanboys, that was usually sums up my feelings between Star Wars and Star Trek. But I've been willing to give Star Trek a go in this very new generation of it.
So the main thing that, and I was hoping this was going to work out, because I went and saw the film a few weeks ago now, and you saw it at the world premiere.
Yes, yes.
And I was hoping that it would work out this way, and I think it has. I was hoping that I'd come across and go, Star Trek's the awesomes and I loves it and it's still super cool, man. And that you'd come along and you'd say, well, I love popcorn movies. And it was awesome fun.
And it is that. It is a very fun film. It picks up where I think a lot of blockbusters have been going lately. Things like starting back from sort of The Dark Knight to even the Bourne series, the Bonds, the Avengers, they are just a fun rollicking. So back to that sort of roller coaster adventure of like films of the 80s that we sort of grew up with.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I know that a lot of people, they tend to think, you know, if it's not art, then it's not worth watching. But damn, it's good to sit back and just enjoy sitting in a cinema for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and walk out feeling jazzed. You know, you don't necessarily feel elated or sad. You don't want to go and hang yourself from a tree or you know, have a warm bath with a packet of razor blades. Sometimes you just walk out and it's fun.
Well, I think the important thing is to remember as well, it takes no real background knowledge to go to a movie. You can just go in. You don't need to learn the entire world that you're going into. Just go in and be told, these are the good guys, these are your bad guys, let's go. Let's just see where this goes. Throw in some special effects, and we're usually happy if it's not dumbed down too much, which, again, some of those blockbusters, things like what the Fast and the Furious franchises become and films like that, are trying to go too much on the special effects, and it just doesn't work. Things like you need to have the balance, and I think Star Trek's hitting that at the moment.
Yeah, so, I mean, the reboot by J.J. Abrams has been wildly successful, and the initial film, I personally, you know, I went along with my wife, and she's not a Star Trek fan, although, she, you know, we watched a few episodes of Voyager together, and she tolerated that. She's not a massive fan. She's pretty much like yourself, except not hairy. And she, you know, I took her along to the first film, and she really enjoyed it, and that's that whole popcorn element. Now, this film, I don't necessarily think that you have to see the first one. It'd help, because you have that grasp of the characters and what they've been through already, but I don't think it's essential to see the first film.
No, I think they set the characters up pretty quickly, and at the end of the day, they're iconic. I think the minute you say Star Trek, everyone, even if you haven't, I'd never seen the films, and I could list most of the crew members. I think through, and you can do it with any, you can do it with Adam's Family, you can do it with Indiana Jones, you can do it with Star Wars. Even if you haven't seen the franchises, you'd be able to rattle off at least a few characters. And I think that's part of the success of that first film is, and I hated myself for saying it, when I came out of that, I enjoyed that probably more than some of the Star Wars prequels. And I'm a Star Wars fan. And
some of? Come on, man.
And I walked out of it going...
By some of, do you mean all three?
I shouldn't be enjoying... This is Star Trek. This is the arch enemy. I shouldn't be enjoying it. But I came out of it going...
Did you feel like you got kissed on the mouth by a guy and then liked it a little bit?
It did, and there was a little bit of movement. And I said, this isn't right. I had to go home and have a shower and had to like go back and force myself to watch Phantom Menace going, oh, I feel so much better. I'm back home. But I think that's it's the power of not only the themes that it goes into and the characters, but also the way in which JJ has made it. And it is a very stylish production.
All right. Now, as people may or may not know... I did have the honour recently of sitting in on a round table with J.J. Abrams himself. A massive, massive buzz, and I was just absolutely jazzed for the whole experience. And I asked him, how did you go about striking that balance so that you're pleasing Star Trek fans, because you do need to please Star Trek fans. It is a voracious fan base. But also delivering a film that just your everyday Joe would enjoy. And this is what he said. First of all, thanks for making the Star Trek movies that me as a lifelong Star Trek fan have wanted to see.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you very much.
I mean, I've tried with my wife. I've tried to watch it. Trust me, it's really good. And then every time I've done that, she's disliked me a little bit more. But with your films, I can take her along as the average punter.
Mm.
And she's enjoyed it. So in this film especially, there's a lot of nods that Star Trek fans will get that other people won't get.
Sure.
How did you go about striking a balance so that you're not losing the average Joe, but you're pleasing us?
Well, thank you for that. I will say that I couldn't have done that because I didn't really know those things, but luckily the writers do. And Bob Orsi particularly is, I would say he's insane about Star Trek. He knows the arcane details you cannot believe. He knows without having to reference and look up stuff. I mean, every once in a while there's something he's like, I don't know. Let me, and I'm like, what? Like, he knows everything. So he's the guy who, you know, and the other writers, in fairness as well, really do know what is, you know, what are the things, the characters, the references to, you know, ships and you know, different, like the Section 31 referenced, you know. I wouldn't have done Section 31, but they, of course, did, and it became, so that there are things that you don't need to know this. My favorite movies reference things outside the purview of the film itself, and it expands the world and it makes the thing feel like it exists in a universe. This movie does that as well. Some of these references, if you happen to see the movie that we did in 2009, if you happen to watch the series, you'll get an extra bonus, but it's all icing. This movie was not made, I should say this, this movie was made for you not to have to have seen anything. And in fact, I would say that our goal was to make a movie that doesn't rely on the last film, especially because a lot of sequels that I've seen make this mistake of assuming you care and sort of starting the story without really reinvesting in the characters. And suddenly you're into the second act and you're like, I there was no way in. And I think that it was critical that we say this is its own thing. It must, if it works, it's going to work on its own merits. If you happen to have seen any earlier incarnations, great, but not required. Thank you. And tell your wife I'm sorry.
So what he's saying is that he approached it as a novice himself and didn't really know about the Star Trek universe. But I suppose part of it, and he did say that, you know, the people around him were the real inspiration. He wanted to make sure that they were happy because they love the franchise. But I think it comes back to what you said. They are iconic characters. And, I mean, everyone knows Shatner. Everyone knows Leonard Nimoy. And, I mean, even if it's just through The Big Bang Theory.
Mm.
Like, heaven forbid I mention it. I know there's a lot of geeks out there that hate it. Me personally, if you can't laugh at yourself, then something's wrong. But Big Bang Theory, I mean, that's a massive blockbuster series. They cash in on these things as well. So those characters must be iconic to, you know, the broad population.
And I think the problem is when you're making some of these big franchises, there is a big fan base. It's like there is with Star Wars. But that's not what's making these films box office hit that they are. As big as, and we've seen recently with all the comic book films like Kick-Ass, Red, and a couple of the other big names that have been tried to from the smaller known indie comics, thinking there's this huge market there based on what Iron Man and the Avengers have been able to do at the box office. But most times they're only really turning around between sort of $40 and $60 million, because that's the size of the audience that it is.
Mm-hmm.
They're not huge. So you've got to then go outside that audience. The Star Trek audience, they'll come no matter what you put up there. You could put Christopher Pine sitting in a blank room just on a chair by himself talking to Spock. People, they're going to come out for that because it's Star Trek on the big screen, and that's what they want as a diehard film fans. But it's how you get to that bigger market than just than the bankable Star Trek fans.
Yeah, so that's interesting that you bring that up, because Brian Burke, producer and member of Bad Robot, he was at an IMAX preview screening that I went to months ago, and he said that one of the things that he felt that Star Trek had done wrong, and he didn't say wrong, and I don't want him to be attacked by Star Trek fans with a batleth or something, but what he felt as though Star Trek was missing is that they were making Star Trek movies for Star Trek fans. No, and this is going back to the 10 movies of Next Gen and the original series, and he just felt as though they were going through the motions, making movies for the fans, but that limited your box office takings, and I'm sure that that's not everything, but at the same time, if you can keep making money, you can keep making movies.
Mm.
Now, so their focus was to branch out and make something that was, it was palatable to everyone. And me personally, I mean, I would have been one of those people to go and see Spock and Kirk, in a white room. But this is something else. And as much as the first film was fantastic, this next one, Into Darkness, it's a word that gets bandied around so much, but it really is epic. Like, the scale is massive.
And it's a seamless production design. Like, I know, and I don't mean to bring up straight away the lens flares of J.J. Abrams, which are excessive and on show in Star Trek Into Darkness, but they do show the gloss. Everything is a gloss. Everything is... everything does, like, and it was with the original Star Trek, the first Star Trek, they said everything looked like it was made by Apple, and that's the same in this one. The world is immaculately designed, but it carries through the entire film from, like, it's, you can see why he's the heir apparent to Spielberg, like, and why he's been tapped to be one of the next, well, he is one of the heavy hitters of Hollywood at the moment, because it is a phenomenal looking film.
Yeah, it really is. And, I mean, it goes to him making fun films, and it really does feel like, when we were kids and watching Spielberg films for the first time, and it was just, it was incredible, and they were polished films for their time, and they still hold up well today. And for me, as a Trekkie, I feel as though the whole world being polished, and, San Francisco looked incredible, and London looked incredible, the ships looked incredible, even their uniforms and everything. To me, that's exactly what the United Federation of Planets should look like. It should look immaculate, and it should kind of look like Apple's taken over, because we as humanity have finally got our act together, and it's taken aliens to come to Earth for us to realise, well, maybe we shouldn't be going around killing each other.
And that's always been the beauty of Star Trek, that we've solved Earth. We know the problem. We've solved all the problems here. That's why we go to these other universes, to go find other... That's where we go and encounter problems when we're meeting people other than what we've done and what we've accomplished. And that's always been the beauty of the storytelling of it.
And here's the kicker. Now, we're going to avoid spoilers as much as possible. If one slips in, please don't write or mail us death threats. We don't take kindly to that. So no spoilers. Earth gets attacked. And Earth gets attacked from within, something that seems unconscionable. Nobody sees it coming, and then when it finally does happen, all hell breaks loose. Now, Cumberbatch, like, for a guy named Benedict Cumberbatch, his name sounds like a professor from Hogwarts. That dude's badass. Like, he
is in another film to everyone in this. He's an amazing actor compared to he pants everyone in this film. It's phenomenal. Yeah.
It's really, to me, he is akin to Alan Rickman in Die Hard. Like, It's just you sort of when you're watching Die Hard and you go, like, that dude's awesome. Yeah, there's this guy walking around on broken glass and everything else. But that dude is awesome.
And yet you catch yourself going, he's acting, right? Like, he knows this is at the end of the day, it's just a movie. When we say cut, he actually cuts. He's not doing this for real. I had my doubts when they first cast him, and the first screenshots that came out, I didn't think he'd fit at all.
I kind of had my doubts as well, but at the same time, I also felt as though, you know, he's done Sherlock and he's done Parade's End, and you know, he's got this booming English voice, which is just—it's like I don't know—it's kind of like a badass, angry Neil Gaiman, which nothing wrong with that. But then I kind of thought, well, I wonder if people thought the same thing about, you know, Jean-Luc Picard.
Mm.
They're thinking, well, he's like a Shakespearean actor, but he does a really great job, and he's truly like menacing.
But he puts across like it. That voice goes, it gives him an almost physical presence that he shouldn't have. If you look at him and go, like you say, he should be this quirky character that I want to laugh at. But I sit there, he's chilling in some scenes. Mm.
So he plays an incredible bad guy. You know, and one thing that he does, he actually takes us to, he takes us somewhere else, off world. Mm. And we'll dance around this a little bit. Now, in the screening that I was in, I was next to Blake from Graffiti with Punctuation, and massive rookie move on my behalf, where I've actually squealed.
You put your arm around his shoulder, or
no. He loves it, loves it. No, I actually made a noise where I squealed a little bit, because this was a big deal for me, and just to actually go to this place and experience. That big action sequence is just off the hook, yeah. Man. It was really awesome. And that was the point where I thought Cumberbatch is something else. Like, yeah. I didn't expect this from him. And he could seriously be an action star.
I can't see a role that he couldn't do at the moment. I'd like to actually see what he could just do in a generic dramatic role. Because he brings so much to... And it'll be interesting to see what he brings to the next installment of The Hobbit as Smaug. So with that voice alone, like, he is incredible.
Now that whole scene, apart from the action and Cumberbatch himself, for me, I was just excited because I thought, well, here's a setup for number three. Whereas I think you saw it slightly different.
Well, there is some fan service going on, but I think it could also be the crumbs being left for the trail to follow on the next occasion. I think it's so hard when you look at a franchise this big, which has already hundreds of stories which have already told, and everybody is lining up to say, make sure you include these people, make sure you include these species, make sure you include this storyline or this character or this arc. It's hard, but I think the way they're doing it at the moment is just taking us through the universe without actually putting the spotlight on anyone in particular. Gives them so much more freedom for storytelling going forward.
Yeah, and the thing that I do like about that is that we haven't seen a great deal of different species or anything like that. We sort of see, you know, he wakes up in bed next to a couple of different ones and stuff like that. But what they're doing is it kind of feels as though, up until now, it feels as kind of normal, you know, like they're just walking along and there's like a, I don't know, there's all these different species that.
And again, I think that's because the costume and graphics are so good that
you're not particularly drawn to it.
No, it doesn't look like they're saying, "Oh, here's a CG character. Look how we can go interact with it." They don't even call attention to it. So it makes sense. It's almost like back to Star Wars, back to the Mos Eisley Cantina. That works because it was practical effects, but it works because we didn't draw attention to any of the characters. They were just people in a bar having a drink. You mean, and if you see that...
As opposed to, like, Sebulba?
Exactly, maybe? Exactly. Or Jake Lloyd yelling, yippee.
Yeah.
Yippee, it's a Chapor snippet.
But the best thing about if you don't draw attention to any graphics or characters, well, I'll accept that world. If you want to walk me through a crowded bar scene or a crowded hall, especially when Spock and Kirk get pulled in front of their superiors in this, he's walking past other people of the Federation, you think... That's you would do that on a day-to-day basis. There are people just going on about their, like a crazy anthill.
Even in the boardroom, you know, like you sort of you go, oh yeah, there's RoboCop. You look at RoboCop straight away because he's RoboCop. Yeah. And you think, where's the baby food?
And talk about badass. He's Peter Weller's still got it.
Yeah, I still wouldn't want to go toe-to-toe with him. He can keep all the Gerber. But even there, like all around the table, there were different species and you could be sort of forgiven for not even noticing. You know, they don't particularly... It's not that they don't draw the eye, but, you know, you're drinking in the scene, not one particular part of the scene, which I appreciate.
And because JJ's good at bringing the focus back on always having action in the scene. What are we doing? And it's that collaborative sort of leadership that is used all throughout. And all throughout this movie, Kirk's constantly seeking advice, seeking counsel from other characters. And it's great because it draws in everyone and we're learning more about everyone and the development's going bit by bit. Instead of just saying, bang, this is what we're going to do. We've got to get to this planet to do this, to do that, to do that. He's bringing in all these different characters, getting in all these different opinions. I think it works far better.
Speaking of different characters, there are all these little things, and there's a lot of nods to Trekkies. You know, there's a lot of things that we can drink in, Section 31, and even to the point of like the Tribble, which people go, "Oh, it's a pretty lame looking little fuzzball," which it is. Don't get me wrong, but like the Troubles with Tribbles is one of the most legendary original series episodes out there, even though it was only, you know, three series long. They could have gone with something else. They could have gone with any number of little critters, any kind of animal, whatever, but they went with a Tribble because I feel as though that was a little nod to us, you know.
And I think that's how J.J. Abrams looks like, how he does his storytelling. We go back to something like Super 8 that he made was a love letter to his younger days of filmmaking, back when it is at, you know, the Super 8 camera, going out, you're with your friends in hokey little costumes trying to film things. And it's telling us something about his background. And again, it had that Spielberg feel because it was capturing the essence of what it was to be a young filmmaker. So you put that, you lay that over the top of something like Star Trek. He's not going to go through and have to reference everything, but why not go into a scene and go, we can put a little fortune cookie here. I'm not going to put the spotlight on it. I'm just going to let it happen organically. And I'm not going to make it drive the storytelling like a couple of droids that had to end up in episodes 1, 2, 3 of Star Wars.
Yep.
To make sure, with that really like banging on your foot going, do you see it? Do you see it? Do you see what we're doing here? We're bringing in this because you've seen it before in the franchise.
Aren't we clever?
Aren't we so good? You never knew it was going to happen. But it's just it's a lovely way to do it because I'd just go through the film not seeing any of them but enjoy it on a different level to what you're seeing.
And that's the best thing because I could only imagine how, you know, if you're unversed in the universe, how annoying must it be to sit there and go, oh, that must mean something. You know, that'd just be jarring. It'd bring you out of the moment.
Well, it's like watching a 2D film that you know is being filmed for 3D as well, and you see the effects coming out.
They're
and you
throwing
go,
something at the screen.
That must be for 3D, and it takes you instantly out. Or when bad 3D can take you instantly out. It's those little nods that make him. He's really got his finger on the pulse, which is excellent to see. Because I can't think of really how many other filmmakers at the moment you would want some of these big tentpole franchises being looked after.
And On a little bit of a tangent and off franchise, it instantly puts me at ease for him being behind the helm of Star Wars.
The scene when the boardroom is attacked and we see John Hamilton, I don't think this is too much of a spoiler to say, he's manning a helicopter or a craft and shooting up the boardroom. It's in the trailer. It's not much of a spoiler. But the colours going around that, I thought, again, this is his love letter to Star Wars. There were the reds and the blues, and I just started thinking, when this guy gets his hand on Star Wars, the John Williams score, because you could get... the score was great for Star Trek. It was amazing. It wasn't... just didn't quite have that kick, like a John Williams theme. I wasn't coming out sort of humming it as I was driving home, which I sometimes do when it's a really catchy tune. But I just think he's in a great position, especially if good producers are going to be involved for Star Wars. And again, so much, it's just a big sandbox for him to go and play in.
Yeah, it's that's not why we're here. But at the end of the day, it's just a fun film. I don't know how else to put it. It's a really fun film. Me personally, I can't wait to see it again. But it's also, it's kind of reinvigorated my love of Star Trek. And usually I sort of find myself, jumping back into the world of Star Trek and stuff like that when there's another release, you know, when something comes out on Blu-ray or whatever. But after watching this, it kind of brought back a lot of the memories from when I was a kid and when I was watching it for the first time, and some of the awe and the joy of this incredible universe that feels so fleshed out. That's one thing that he nailed. It feels completely lived in.
Oh, definitely. For as polished as it is, it still feels like everyone has their place. You get when Kirk's in a bar at one stage, you know, sitting there in his leather jacket, drinking a scotch, and it just looks gorgeous. Again, like, I've never seen a glass that looks that great on screen, yeah. But it looks real. They look like they're in just a regular bar. And even some of the other worlds that we get to see are fantastic.
Yeah, that world in the opening scene is just, that's something else. Like, that looks gorgeous, and some of the shots from that, I mean, it's really heart-racing stuff, that entire opening sequence.
I kept thinking it was, like, everything going through my head was, it's tactile. I just want to reach out and touch everything. It looks, you know, like, man-made, and it looks real, it looks organic, and it looks like, the problem with most people who use graphics are, if we need to make a scene where we need computer graphics to design a beach, okay, then we're going to make the beach 50 miles long and have huge waves. When you think, go down to one of our local beaches here in Sydney, they're a kilometre and a half long, but full of detail. And it gives a bit more perspective to what you're actually looking at. Just because we can create this huge world doesn't necessarily mean we have to, for the sake of the storytelling.
Yeah, and one thing that JJ did say at this, Mr. Abrams said at this roundtable, is that all of that opening sequence, within reason, was man-made. You know, they used sets and they used costumes and they used makeup instead of using CGI, which is another thing that excites me about Star Wars. And that opening scene was just, that was something else. And there is a lot of CGI and, you know, the ship and everything else, it's all CGI instead of using, you know, traditional effects, models and such. But it's still, at no point did I find myself being pulled out of the scene. You know, I wasn't sort of going, oh, that's CGI, oh, that's fake,
yeah,
or anything else. It was really seamless.
That is the biggest challenge for when you're looking at something where, you know, you're going back to that childhood state of that suspension of disbelief. Of course we know it's not real, but if the storytelling is good enough, it shouldn't matter. And it's a frantic pace of this film for the first, like, half an hour. From where we start to where we are half an hour in, you just think, and it's so believable how we got to where we were, and you
but
just
at the
think,
same time you go, how did we get here?
Yeah,
how did we get here so quick? Now, one thing that I absolutely loved about this, there's one particular part in the film. It's a very emotional part, and that's set up perfectly a couple of scenes earlier with Uhura and Spock and Kirk in a ship together. That is just the emotional core that sets up this later scene to be as affecting as it is.
That's great script writing.
It really is.
That was rapid fire. The banter going back and forth was so believable.
That's Kirk and Spock, man. They just, Zachary Quinto and Chris Pine, they nail the banter.
Oh, their chemistry is fantastic.
But then Zoe Saldana, she does a fantastic job as sort of the third wheel as well. But yeah, that sort of set up a moment, and I actually felt emotionally affected in that later scene, partially because there was that emotional setup earlier on, and that was just genius, but also because it has massive reference to earlier films or an earlier film, and just gets flipped on its head. Other people might not notice, but for me it was...
They're
so well executed.
They walk this fine line between paying homage to it and a really glossy parody.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. It's such a fine line between, like, an homage to something and being a slave to it.
And there's the classic skit, I think Dawn French did it with, like, paying out Lord of the Rings, and she just did 9 minutes of people walking across a field in England.
Yeah.
And everyone came away going, well, isn't that really what Lord of the Rings was? It was a $600 million franchise, which effectively that's what it, like, it was people walking. But the fact that we were drawn into that for 9 hours and so engrossed in it, it became more than that. And the thing for I found with Star Trek, like, I look when people do their famous lines, and we see the Spock lines and the Kirk lines that I know only through a process of osmosis, like everyone does, through that I get my Star Trek stuff through pop culture references.
Yep.
I just find they earn every single laugh they go for, and it's tongue in cheek for the most part. When they say one of the corny lines, there is this winking to the audience that they go, yeah, we know what we're doing, and you know we're doing it, so just let us keep going. And you grant them that sort of permission to do it, because they're doing it, they're handling it with such respect, and also there's a real sense of vibrancy about the way they're handling it. It's very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, it's just good, it's fun, it's definitely, it's a blockbuster. Like, it's a popcorn blockbuster film, you know, it's the summer release for America, and I as much as I'm a comic book nerd, and I love Iron Man and everything else, I kind of hope that it smashes Iron Man's teeth in.
Hmm.
You know, because
I only saw Iron Man last night, and it's completely, it really nails things that Iron Man, I think, misses, because it goes back to those core emotions that I think it focuses on, like the those ideas of sort of the love, honor, and friendship. And they're such basic storytelling devices anyway. And you think that's what, you know, what makes Star Wars so good. It's those simple ideals that it sort of goes forward with. And I think that's really what Star Trek tapped in. And I think it might be one of the biggest hits of the summer, or the American summer.
Yeah, unfortunately, what it has working against it is the fact that it's Star Trek.
Mm.
And I've spoken to people at work about it, and I've said, you know, you should really watch this. It's really good. And they said, oh, I don't do Star Trek.
Yeah.
Oh, well, neither does my wife. Neither does my mate Stu.
No.
And they loved it. So give it a crack, yeah?
And I think that the name J.J. Abrams is getting people in the door. But even that's only, he's only big as well in the geek community as well. Yeah. I mean, I think you've got to tell people, well, he came up with Lost, and he's done Mission Impossible 3, and he's done all these other films. But
there's a couple of things that I noticed with a lot of the, I don't know if you've noticed, a lot of the one-sheet posters, the Into Darkness is quite big.
Yes.
The Star Trek above, and a little bit smaller.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's definitely part of it. They're trying to sort of market it, not so much as a Star Trek film, but as Into Darkness.
But it's weird, because I wonder what the actual face of Star Trek is now, because it's not really, I think these last couple of films have brought the franchise, not even kicking and screaming, into the modern era, but this thing is now one of the, like, is one of the trendsetters for what sort of your big action adventure film should be. It's far, like, this is what makes me excited for Star Wars. Not because I see there is any competition with Star Trek, but as I say, it's now a benchmark of what we expect as fans. We want smart, sophisticated, and fun at the same time. We don't want just the dumb fun anymore, just the explosions. And I always think now what it must be like. Everyone says, oh, with, you know, the next Star Wars film's coming out, 7, 8, 9, they go, oh, thank goodness, like, they'll be so much better than the prequels. And you think, imagine the pressure on that writer now, who's been handed the assignment of writing Episode 7, and George Lucas sitting back and saying, all right, if you know how easy it is to make one of these big blockbusters work, go on, Hotshot. Show me how it's done.
Yeah, it's not like I've ever made a movie or anything. Yeah. You jerk.
So you try and you take with so much baggage that Star Trek has going in to what they've now said, all right, this is our benchmark. This is where we are. And it's the same with Skyfall last year for Bond. That sort of cleaned the slate and said, right, we are now a cinematic film as well as one for the fans. And I, you know, it sets, if that's what the new benchmark is going to be for both franchises, it's amazing what the future is going to hold for them.
And it's pretty great that, you know, we're in a position where that benchmark is to be met by the same director.
Exactly, exactly. And what the challenge is going forward now is in the Star Trek franchise itself, is who do you get to come in? Because JJ obviously is going off to do Star Wars. But now we're at this place with tentpole films, and that we're getting the best directors. It's not these jobbers that are coming along going, right, point and shoot. Yep, do I tell everyone it's a Star Trek film? Do I tell everyone it's a Bond film? Come and see it. there's girls and there's explosions. Now you're going to have to go, well, no, we want more. And people won't come out unless you are continuing it on. Like, imagine, and I've said this before in a couple of my reviews, imagine doing something daring, like throw Star Trek out to Quentin Tarantino. Like, it's as much as he's all about the exploit films, imagine what he could do in terms of character and the dialogue and the fun he would have. You know, there might be a few more explosions, there might be a bit more blood for the average Trekkie fan.
There'd be a lot of red shirts just dismembered and everything else. You couldn't quite hear that on the recording here, but I just rolled my eyes at Stu when he mentioned that. Now, one thing that was talking about earlier with spoilers and everything else, J.J., Mr. Abrams, he nailed one thing on the head that I absolutely loved. You know, he asked us, just go light on the spoilers, can we leave some of the mystery there? And he started talking about how there's a sense of entitlement to information nowadays. And it is a big part of, the internet and the immediacy of Twitter and stuff like that, where when you're a kid, you'd go and see a movie and there'd be twists and, you know, I mean, as much as everyone heard about The Sixth Sense and what was going on there, but nowadays it's instant. And he sort of touched on, and it's not just in films, it's in, like, the government. Oh, the government are keeping secrets from us and what's really in the water, and we demand to know everything. And it's sort of...
How does Zumbo make his macarons? I want to know.
Who knows? With love and unicorn poo. Now, that, to me, like, the spoilers, I don't know if they'd necessarily ruin... They definitely wouldn't ruin the film. This would still be an incredibly fun movie. I think the only people that it would really affect would be people like me that have seen the other films and have watched all of the Star Trek, you know, back catalogue and everything, because some of the little twists and sort of, you know, knowing who the villain is and everything else, it really would have no holding for you at all.
No, and there's nothing that's really, in saying that, there's nothing that really hasn't been explored before in big action films. There's nothing that we're saying is so out of left field, but for me, I sort of just went with it. I sort of went, oh, okay, is that, oh, all right, is that where we're going?
That's
okay.
How it works. Cool. Yeah,
very good. I'm happy to keep going with it, but...
Was that even after being explained by a certain mystery character?
It was a little heavy-handed, where we sort of took a pause to sort of be everyone to be brought up to speed. It was sort of that feeling when the bank robbery gets done and then we get taken through step by step how we pulled it off and how we got away with it and how...
Come on, you're a big Ocean's
fan. Ever so clever. I like it at the end. But, I mean, even that... I mean, as sort of clunky as it was, and it's a means to get across that that exposition, it took me out of it slightly, but I sort of just went, right, that's within the parameters that this world has now been set up with. It's consistent to the rules of the universe, and I'm happy with that. And that's one thing I like going from film to film in a franchise, and why I worry about JJ leaving the franchise is who's there keeping those things consistent. So it's what makes a film like Inception so brilliant, because they go, here are the rules we're going to play by, and for the next 2.5 hours you go, cool, you stuck to the rules and nothing you did was outside them, and I don't feel cheapened, and I accepted that we're in dreams upon dreams upon dreams. So for Star Trek, I'm happy to play along like that.
One thing that Inception did better than, and this is only, you know, it's like 2 minutes of exposition, but I always find that if you're going to tell me how things are working, tell me throughout the film. You know, don't just lump it in all at once.
Yeah.
Now, the spoiler guys, Mark Fennell, Giles Hardy and Alice Tynan, they were recently talking about Oblivion and how heavy-handed the exposition was at the beginning, and they just bring you up to speed with everything. This is what happened, and then this guy had a sandwich, but he didn't really like it, so he sent it back, and he demanded a pickle, and then he got his pickle, and then it was happy, and now we've got...
Probably wasn't as good as he thought it was going to be, but he ate it anyway, because he'd made such a big point about the pickle.
And everyone was talking about these things called Rubens, and he actually thought it was something different. Yeah. He thought it was a type of biscuit.
But it's important to know. Like, this is the kind of stuff we need to know about the character before he sets off on his major quest.
That's true. I mean, on his sandwich quest. And true, like, Oblivion was very heavy-handed, and they just got you up to speed, and then Tom Cruise. But with this, it was a little bit jarring, and it was heavy-handed fan service. You know, like it was just pandering to Star Trek fans. But it was brief, very brief.
It was, and it still kind of worked because they weaved it in around everything else that was going on in the film. So there was enough to, and it was only a bit of a sidetrack. So it wasn't.
Yeah, and I also felt as though that particular scene it really showed a vulnerability.
Yeah.
To Spock.
Yeah.
That you didn't necessarily see, and you probably could have shown it in different ways. Mm. But it definitely showed a vulnerable side that we hadn't necessarily seen yet.
And as you mentioned, it's all in service of a payoff later on, which is it's that slow build which makes the payoff work. If we didn't have those little moments where we see change in him or a bit of conflict, the payoff wouldn't work. So by that, you sort of have to give it pay it its dues that they're doing the right thing. So even if they go, slightly heavy-handed, it's for a good cause. But it's
the setup.
Yeah,
you know,
which is all the more reason to allow it in. So
absolutely. Now I think we'll pretty much wrap up here because we're probably boring people. Or if we're not, then you know, just listen to this again. I really enjoyed it. I implore everyone, like, if you're going to go see Iron Man, that's all well and good, and go see Iron Man because you know, really great fun action film. Go see Star Trek. If you're scared of Star Trek because it's called Star Trek, just call it Into Darkness. Mm. They'll know what you're talking about. Go down, watch it. You don't have to be a Star Trek fan, as Stu has told us. It's just fun.
This is what summer movies are. This is what the big blockbusters are. This is what we do it every year, come in for this season. This is just fun. Like you say, I can't remember a time when I've had an experience coming out of a film where I sort of just... I was on cloud nine. I didn't even get that with the Avengers, because the Avengers, I sort of went... Okay, yeah, you finally pulled it off. You got there, and by the end of it, I sort of went, "All right, you've pulled off something impressive." But this is just—I will probably end up buying this on Blu-ray when it comes out because I'm that impressed.
Well, that's good to know. I won't borrow your copy because I'll buy my own. Now, stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. Over the next couple of weeks, or next couple of days, actually, what we're going to have, we're going to be posting the full roundtable audio of our discussion with J.J. Abrams. We'll also be posting a review of the Star Trek video game, which I'm not going to get ahead of myself, but apparently it's terrible. And we'll also be reviewing the first season of Star Trek Enterprise on Blu-ray. So stay tuned, and thanks for listening.